Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening, and Happy New Year, everyone. In 2014, we said hello to a new era for the U.S. and Cuba. We visited a city named Sochi, a faraway comet named 67P, and we watched as the group ISIS said hello to the whole world. Things that were a problem in 2013 stayed a problem in 2014, such as gridlock in Congress, the war in Syria, the Taliban war in Pakistan, tensions in Israel and Gaza, Boko Haram's insurgency in Nigeria, and the persistent racial tensions in U.S. communities experiencing violence and tensions between citizens and law enforcement. Things we didn't imagine would concern us at all grabbed our attention in 2014. Malaysian Airlines had a pair of sudden, tragic events in the spotlight. A plane that vanished somewhere in the Pacific, and another one that was shot down over eastern Ukraine. Sony's personal emails and a suspected hack attack from North Korea that derailed a Hollywood movie release came out of nowhere. The Cold War made a comeback in eastern Europe unexpectedly. Among the scheduled milestones in 2014, the World Cup in Brazil went off without a hitch, although Germany won, which might count as a hitch for the Brazilian team. Nearly murdered Pakistani teenager Malala Yousafzai became the youngest winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, a prize she shared with Indian education activist Kailash Siddharthi. Global warming seemed to cool off in some places, but actually got worse worldwide. And the GOP took back the U.S. Senate in the 2014 midterms and made significant gains in the House. As it says in Ecclesiastes, a time to be born, a time to die, but the people we say goodbye to each year always makes it seem like a cluster of loss. For 2014, Robin Williams, Joan Rivers, Lauren Bacall, Mickey Rooney, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Tom Malyazzi of Car Talk, all gone. This hour, a year loosely in review, and tomorrow we'll look ahead to the next 12 months of 2015, but we begin with the state of the economy. From lower oil prices to a drop in unemployment to record auto recalls, how did the economy fare in this past year? Heidi Moore, finance and economics editor at The Guardian, watched it all unfold. She begins with the numbers.
If you're in the stock market, 2014 has been a dream come true. If you have invested in other kinds of things, like perhaps bonds or oil or gold, perhaps it hasn't been your year. But it was a good year for making money, but even better, I think, a year in which we really started to think seriously about the ways in which money is made. And we saw a lot of the outrage over the financial crisis in 2009, 2010, 2011 really move towards a broader, more congressional voice in the form of Elizabeth Warren, in the form of Carl Levin, in the form of even Nancy Pelosi in the most recent dust up, more of Congress actually wondering how Wall Street is making its money and talking about that openly, which we haven't seen in previous years.
Meanwhile, the economy moves on. Let's focus on manufacturing. I mean, in manufacturing in 2014, the story was really General Motors.
Yes. The automotive industry has had an extraordinary year in which it's really managed to avoid consequences for a lot of trouble, but still do really, really well. So almost record car sales in some cases. At the same time, record recalls. And so many recalls that there's actually recall fatigue among consumers. People aren't bringing in their cars because there are so many recalls. They don't even know where to start. They don't want to give up the time. It's like trying to make a terrible dentist appointment. There's so many things to get fixed. No one has the time to do it. So at the same time, the automotive companies, GM, Chrysler, so on, are able to sell so many cars because it's so easy to get a loan, a car loan. Record car loans right now and record subprime auto lending as well. So a lot of the people who are borrowing, about a third of them are subprime borrowers who are taking out auto loans.
Those 0% APR commercials are really a story of the Federal Reserve, which is keeping quantitative easing going and keeping the price of money down.
Yes, exactly. I think that there was a lot of talk about the end of quantitative easing. All they really did was stop buying. But the Fed is still in the bond market, and those record low interest rates are having a wide effect on the whole economy, on us as consumers, right? Because we are taking out more of those car loans. We're using more of our credit cards as well. For companies, because they're taking out more loans, and some of those companies would also be considered subprime borrowers. And also for countries, right? You're seeing countries like Venezuela and Russia and Brazil very active in the bond markets. And so you're seeing this kind of widespread flow of debt because of these low interest rates in the U.S. that's having a knock-on effect in other countries.
Nothing low about interest rates in Russia, 17%. And I suspect that on everybody's top 10 list, at the top of everybody's top 10 list of the economic stories of 2014, has to be the slide in oil prices, which really leads us almost everywhere else this year.
Yeah, the slide in oil prices did a lot to expose the weaknesses in the economy that had been papered over. So, you know, you saw OPEC, where Saudi Arabia and some of the Middle Eastern economies have a stranglehold on oil prices, almost completely lose their power. You saw shale oil producers that produce oil by fracking here in the United States do really well, and they have a lot of leverage. And then you're seeing all of this cheap gas for consumers that you would think would encourage people to think more about the environment, you know. We have this oversupply of gas. Instead, what it's doing is that more people are buying SUVs and pickup trucks. Cheaper gas means bigger cars. That's just kind of the American way right now. And then you're also seeing a knock-on effect from oil in companies. So energy companies that have borrowed so much to drill and to finance their operations.
They're in trouble.
They're going to be in trouble. And 2015 is going to be a really rough year for them because we have this oversupply of oil. And we really depend on those companies to keep investing in equipment. And they don't have to do that this year. So that's one third of the capital investment of the S&P 500. And that's all going to fade from the economy in 2015 unless oil prices rise. So we have to think about what that means for the rest of us.
So declining oil prices are a stimulus for consumers, but they really put a drag on the heavy industries that are dependent upon energy. And we also saw the direct effect on geopolitics with the slide in the price of oil. Do you think that's going to continue? 2014 was all about Ukraine and the crisis in Russia, with Russia having a strong hand. You see Russia with a very weak hand now at the very start of 2015?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think you're going to see a lot of the oil-dependent economies like Russia, as well as Brazil, Venezuela, Nigeria, really confront the weaknesses that they have as economies that oil money has allowed them to forget about. And so you are going to see more geopolitical problems. Particularly, people are worried about Europe. Germany is very dependent on Russia for trade. And if Russia weakens, then Germany will weaken. So goes the thinking. And if Germany weakens, the Eurozone weakens, because Germany has been so far the strongest economy in that area.
All right, let's talk about jobs in the United States. Unemployment rate under 6%. It's a positive trend, but labor force participation is also down. I mean, there's a huge group of people who have decided to just opt out of the workforce entirely. Is there a clear-cut trend on jobs right now?
The trend has been that we are adding jobs. And if anything, I think the most clear-cut one is that we're adding very low-quality jobs, part-time, low-paid. That's been the most consistent source of job growth. So yes, more people are getting that part-time work. But what we're seeing is people are looking for full-time work, and they're not finding that. So the unemployment rate is falling just because there are a lot of people we aren't measuring. You know, they've dropped out of the workforce, or they're taking a part-time job, or they're not filing for unemployment claims. There are all these different factors. But I think the general theme is people are now taking jobs they may not necessarily want out of desperation.
Income inequality. We love to talk about it. Lots of people agonize over it. Does anyone really care in 2014?
I think you're starting to see some differences, right? So when there was a landmark book that came out this year, Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century, and it really restarted that discussion of inequality. And I think it gave it power, because what you've seen this year are protests and movements to raise the minimum wage to $15 or more in some cases. And that is a direct result of this book, giving people the courage to really talk about inequality, to have the data to back it up. It's also become a core part of discussions of the economy. You've seen Obama mention inequality. You've seen a lot of our top lawmakers mention inequality. A lot of foreign presidents and leaders mention inequality. So there is more discussion of it. And I am a believer that if you're able to discuss it more, it does lead to some form of action. And I think we saw that a little bit in what happened with the congressional budget. There was a secret little provision that would roll back some of the Dodd-Frank financial reforms and give banks more power to take big risks with our savings accounts. And in other years, you would have easily seen that pass with no discussion. And this year, you really saw a rebellion led mostly by Elizabeth Warren, but also joined by Nancy Pelosi, Carl Levin, Sherrod Brown, people saying, this is not the way that we want our capitalism to work. And that's a very powerful change, even in Congress.
So clearer numbers make more tangible this inequality, which up till now has seemed very, very abstract, even though individual consumers can be pretty miserable. A favorite corporate management story of the year?
It's not quite a favorite in terms of approval, I think it's very significant to look at what's happened to SeaWorld and how, and again, the power of consumers and the power of, in some cases, activists to change the way a company does business. So SeaWorld came under fire for its treatment of what we call killer whales, what they call orcas, and that has led to significant changes in the way the company is run, a drop in profits, which is what companies really respond to. And SeaWorld is now reforming the way that it treats those animals in order to have a better image and cater to the public. And I think that really shows that corporate management does respond to public pressure, that these companies are not completely running on their own, that they do respond to profit if we can affect their profit and thus give them a sign about the kind of ethics and morals they should have.
Did the documentary Blackfish perform a Free Willy kind of in real life on SeaWorld?
It did. Blackfish started that whole trend. It's what made it visual and, again, what made it tangible. And that allowed that discussion to really kick off.
Heidi Moore, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Heidi Moore is finance and economics editor at The Guardian. More with Heidi tomorrow as we look ahead to 2015. As we look back upon 2014, we're asking you this hour for your best moments of the past year.
Hi, this is Kamala Whittemore from Rutland, Vermont. My highlight moment of 2014 was that I became legal guardian to three teenage boys from the South Bronx, New York, so they could get out of the projects, come to Vermont, go to school, and live safely.
Hello, this is Deirdre from Glenwood Landing. The highlight of my 2014 was my son's communion. He looked so grown up in his little suit. In 2015, I'm really just looking forward to watching my kids grow up in a peaceful, happy home.
From Virginia, I was given a concert by friends and musicians to wish me well in my recovery from chemotherapy. It was a transcendent several hours. I hope to continue being well so I can give back to my community. From Washington State, we got this text. It was the opposite of a highlight. However, I will never be the same. On November 1st, 2014, we gave our mother's ashes to the ocean at Cannon Beach. That's in Oregon. She died exactly a year ago that day. It was to fulfill our promise to her and to say goodbye. It's a sadness deeper than I knew was there. I think I shall never recover. And for Michael and Medina, 2014 was truly a transformative year.
This is Michael Nielsen from Centerville, Utah. The highlight of 2014 was marriage equality coming to Utah, which I thought would be the last state to get it. And the highlight of 2015 is going to be my wedding to the man I love.
Hi, my name is Medina Cardona, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. 2014 was a coming out year for me. I first came out to my family as a transgender man, then again to my community, and finally I came out to the nation in an interview with John Hockenberry on The Takeaway.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your highlight moments from 2014.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
A transformation in electoral politics was the result of the 2014 midterms. Republican gains and the White House vows to soldier on unilaterally, while the Democrats see splits over ideology. We go now to Capitol Hill and Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Happy New Year, Todd.
And to you, John.
Let's run down your list of the most important political stories on Capitol Hill this year.
Well, on Capitol Hill, of course, the most important political story. The midterm elections, a trouncing for Democrats, there's no doubt about it. John Boehner is going to wind up with 246 seats in the next Congress in the House. He was already in the majority, but this is the largest majority since World War II. Of course, over in the Senate, maybe even a bigger story. Mitch McConnell becoming majority leader. He gained 9 seats, 54 Republican seats. A huge gain for Republicans, big gains across the South. We'll see if that gets undone in 2016, which is a real risk for Republicans. They have a lot of Republican senators running in blue states or moderate states, so this could be a short majority. We don't know, but in terms of 2014, yeah, in politics, that's the big story. But I'll dovetail on that. You know, huge victory for Republicans. The 113th Congress, one of the least productive in the history of the Republic. only about 200 bills passed and signed by the president at this point, John. And that includes all the ceremonial stuff, you know, the naming of coins and post offices, about 125, 26 substantive bills. It's one of the least productive Congresses in the history of the Republic.
So next, in terms of the most important issues that were either touched or untouched in this Congress in 2014.
Well, I think there's a couple more things. I think the president's immigration order, the executive action on immigration, the president really stretched his bounds, probably legally and constitutionally, on this issue. And the normalization of status, at least for 3 years, for up to 5 million people. From a policy perspective, you know, you could say it's pretty huge. Other presidents have taken executive action on deferred deportations or prosecutorial discretion. That part is not really, really new. But the politics of this, the divisions on immigration in the Republican Party and the massive advantage that Democrats are enjoying with Latino voters right now make the executive action on immigration absolutely huge, with untold ramifications as we move forward.
And that's why President Obama doesn't really sound like he's taking much of a risk when he goes out on his own. Listen.
And to those members of Congress who question my authority to make our immigration system work better, or question the wisdom of me acting where Congress has failed, I have one answer. Pass a bill. I want to work with both parties to pass a more permanent legislative solution. And the day I sign that bill into law, the actions I take will no longer be necessary.
Well, we will see if there's any bill to pass in 2015, nothing in 2014. What's next on your list, Todd?
John, the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on detainee treatment and torture, absolutely a huge story, not only politically, but morally in terms of the stance in the war on terror. The reckoning that came from this report really, I think, rocked Washington in the closing days of 2014. It's true that these techniques are no longer used, at least they say they're no longer used. The black sites are closed, as the emphasis under President Obama in the so-called war on terror has really shifted. But it's the kind of report that has the ability to lean on politics and echo through a generation. Any time the U.S. government or intelligence services now are accused of harsh detainee treatment or decisions are trying to be made about how to get information out of suspects, whether it's terror or anything else, the policymakers, the agents, the lawmakers doing oversight, the presidents, the cabinet members will all be thinking about this report, not only what's in it, but the political fallout from the publishing of this report by the Intelligence Committee.
And we may look back and see the publication of this report as the highlight of the decade politically, maybe not just the year 2014, because it will have implications certainly going forward. What would you say is the shakeup, the implication in the early weeks now of this apparent change between Washington and Havana, Cuba? Certainly very relevant to people like Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, who claims his lineage from Cuba. What do you think?
No question. I mean, on a micro level, this upends the politics of the state of Florida. As you draw out, it has major implications for the presidential races, as you said, for Republican politics writ large. There is an entire chapter of Republican politics that relies on opposition to the communist regime in Cuba, opposition to the Castros, the immigrant experience, and really the only sort of subsection, if you will, of Latino voters, Cubans, who reliably vote Republican. It's potentially a major development, taking away one of the major objections of U.S. foreign policy and on Cuban pressure within the Republican Party to stay tough on Cuba.
And before we go, Todd, let's look back at the health of Obamacare. There were a lot of promises made at the beginning of 2014 about repeal and challenges. Where does Obamacare stand right now? And what are the lessons going forward?
Looking back on 2014, the law remains legally fairly solid, politically fairly solid. It remains a major dividing line between Republicans and Democrats, of course, and the new Republican majority in the Senate and the older Republican majority in the House are vowing to take big votes, you know, repealing the individual mandate. They'll keep up with that. Of course, President Obama will veto all those efforts. Analysts around Washington, John, will say that in terms of enrollment, Obamacare has been a moderate success. Maybe not quite as big as the administration had heralded at the beginning of the year. Some 700,000 enrollees who they claimed had signed up for Obamacare actually had just signed up for a dental plan, so take those off the ledger, but about 9 to 10 million enrollees. One place where Obamacare has not been a huge success, I think, in the minds of the public is in controlling health care costs. It simply has not done that. Now, if you had followed the real policy of this bill, one of the major drawbacks of Obamacare is that it's not really designed to control health care costs. A lot of people say it should have been. It really isn't. It's designed to get people enrolled into an existing system. So the cost of healthcare, the amount that insurance companies and consumers pay for the actual treatments and tests they get, keeps going up. And that's going to be something that if Congress and future presidents decide to modify this law instead of fully repeal it, they're really going to have to reckon with that.
2014 on Capitol Hill, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Thanks, Todd.
You got it, John.
More highlights from 2014, and for some of you out there, things are looking up.
This is Nikki in Oakland, California. I was let go from an unethical workplace unexpectedly last March. Since I was already strategizing how to resign with or without a new job, it was actually a relief. The universe has opened with blessings that said, "What on earth were you waiting for?"
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Follow us on Twitter. That's at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
In a moment, we'll tell you about the biggest tech gadget of 2014. You can't buy it. It's that probe that landed on the comet. One small step for a robot coming up. But more down-to-earth robots were part of the rollouts from tech companies in 2014. Consumer robots, worker drones were introduced that are eyeing the beehive of the economy. Alibaba went public. But our next guest says 2014 was the year of reckoning for the online taxi booking service Uber. Darling Uber has lost some of its luster, according to Manoush Zomorodi, host of WNYC's New Tech City podcast. Manoush, welcome.
Hello, John.
And 2014, the year of Uber.
Yeah, and I mean that not like, oh my God, Uber, amazing, they dominated. I mean more like that this company is sort of an illustration of the tension that is being played out when it comes to these tech companies that are, and I'm using air quotes here, disrupting industries for better and worse.
These are very urgent looking air quotes. I mean, if it was going to be that story, Uber, Alice, it would be Alibaba in 2014. But Uber is a much more nuanced and complex story.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big joke in technology is that every tech startup is trying to be the Uber of something. Uber has done an amazing job at infiltrating the sort of taxi and limousine industry. The recent round of funding, they got $1.2 billion. They are now being valued between $35 and $40 billion. They are in over 250 countries. But here's the problem, right? They seem to have a they're kind of jerks, and people are starting to realize that. Yeah. You know, earlier in the year, maybe even last year, there was tension about the fact that they weren't sticking to cities' regulations. They were putting regular taxi drivers out of work. Those sorts of more sort of
automation changing the world.
But exactly.
But let's go down the special cases for Uber. There's the India situation.
Yes.
There's the situation in Australia. Describe what sort of pushes them into another zone here.
Well, so it's sort of not seeming to care very much about their customers. The India situation, a possible rape, a question of whether or not they have vetted any of their drivers enough. New Delhi has now banned Uber entirely. Question of how they use their data. One of the reporting that I did earlier this year was the fact that they didn't disclose that they were rating their passengers. I had no idea that when I got in a car, my behavior was being watched and then rated by the driver. Also, a lot of sexism. The CEO, Travis Kalanick, called his company Boober because he was getting so much action as being CEO. Also in Lyon, in France, they since have pulled this marketing campaign, but the idea was to get women models as drivers and say, look what you get to see when you ride in an Uber, and a big old shot of cleavage. It's basically questionable, you know, not just questionable morals, but a sense that not caring, being above it all, not being the sort of people to whom you want to give business. And I think the best example was my husband. I introduced him to Uber. He came home one day. He said, I used it today. It's great. 2 weeks later, after all of these sort of allegations, he said, I hate them. A great service. Bad people.
Bad
Delete.
People. Goobers.
Right. Yes,
yeah.
Nice.
Like young boys.
Now, look, Travis Kalanick, the CEO, he says that they are turning over a new leaf. I want to read you a quote here. The events of the recent weeks have shown us that we also need to invest in internal growth and change. Not exactly an apology, but maybe an understanding that it's time to grow up a little.
Uber has to ask itself what's more valuable, its capital valuation of well over $1 billion, maybe $30 billion, or its reputation with consumers. Manoush Zomorodi, host of WNYC's New Tech City, thanks so much.
Great to be here, John.
Tomorrow, Manoush talks about the biggest tech trend to watch out for in the year ahead.
I think 2015 is going to be the year of not just self-quantifying, you know, tracking everything you do, but having it all together in one place and maybe sharing it with your doctor, maybe even your workplace. This is where things are going. And I think the Apple Watch is going to be the key thing to watch in 2015.
The Apple Watch, wearable devices and tracking everything we do. Welcome to the present moment in 2015. More tomorrow with Manoush.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And liftoff at dawn. The dawn of Orion and a new era of American space exploration.
That's the countdown from the successful launch of the Orion spacecraft, first test of what could be the first human mission to Mars. It wasn't even the biggest space story this year, though. For the first time, humanity caught a comet and landed a robot called Philae onto it. The Kepler telescope also discovered a massive rocky planet that scientists think might have similar conditions to Earth. And among the setbacks this year, an Antares resupply rocket en route to the International Space Station veered off course and had to be destroyed by NASA controllers. And failure of Virgin Galactic, Spaceship Two was a tragic setback for commercial spaceflight. Emily Rice is a professor of astrophysics at the College of Staten Island and CUNY Graduate Center and a researcher at the American Museum of Natural History. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Emily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what do you think of this year, 2014?
It was a doozy. It was a pretty good one.
For me, the number one is landing on the comet.
I think that was one of the most exciting things that's happened in a while, yeah. And this was, you know, decades in the making, 10 years in travel time. And I love the discovery story of this comet is that they were trying to take an image of one that they thought they had at the center of the field. And then there was another comet off in the corner. And then this was also a secondary target for the mission. The Rosetta launch was delayed. And so when a delay like that happens, you can't go to the same place because the Earth is moving. So they had
comet.
To find a backup comet. Yeah.
Backup comet. So the backup comet wins. And just to see something like that from, you know, anywhere from totally outside of our collection of worlds, the solar system.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very unexpected for it to have such an amazingly complex shape. And it ended up looking like a rubber duck, and now people have 3D printed models of it that, you know, tons of astronomers and planetary scientists have these on their desks. It's so much fun.
I've got to get one. All right, what else?
So one of my favorite things is actually the Cosmos. We talked about it before, but the Cosmos series that it was on TV,
yep,
you know, it
sure.
wasn't an achievement in the research, but to have that kind of outreach going on and to have so many astronomers and scientists talking about it, you know, to their students, to their friends, to their family on Twitter and things like that. For me, this was kind of the year of public interest in astronomy and science and space exploration.
And your colleague, Neil deGrasse Tyson, of course.
How can we humans, who rarely live more than a century, hope to grasp the vast expanse of time that is the history of the cosmos? The universe is 13.8 thousand million years old. In order to imagine all of cosmic time, let's compress it into a single calendar year.
Yeah, I think you did a pretty good job.
Did a pretty good job. There we go. That's right. What did you love in terms of adding to the photo album of space?
I think this one, my favorite one this year, was the ALMA image of HL Tau. It's this ring of dust around a young low-mass star that was released just about a month or so ago by the ALMA is the Atacama Large Military Array. It's a array of radio telescopes in Chile. it looks fake, which I love. It looks like one of the images that we usually make for press releases when we have some kind of result that has to do with the disks around a star where planets are forming. We usually create these beautiful artist representations to show, you know, where the material is, where the planets could be forming and things like that.
Saturn-looking stuff is always sexy, right?
Yeah. And this image looks fake, but it's real. It's real data. You see a beautiful disk around the star. You see gaps in that disk where there could be planets forming. And that's real data, which is beautiful.
It's a nursery of planets being formed around a low-mass star.
Yes, it's a low-mass star, so it's lower mass than the sun. It's also very, very young, which was the exciting thing about it. So the star is less than a million years old. And to see such a kind of processed disk where there are so many features, where there's gaps and rings and things like that, that tells us that the planets are forming very, very early in the lifetime of the star. So that's good news for us in terms of figuring out, you know, how quickly planets form, how many stars are likely to form planets, and find other Earths.
Emily Rice, professor of astrophysics at the College of Staten Island and CUNY Graduate Center and a researcher at the American Museum of Natural History. Happy holidays, and it's been a great 2014, and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, Emily Rice tells us what she's looking forward to in 2015.
New Horizons. New Horizons is going to reach Pluto. That's definitely by far the most exciting thing that's going to happen in 2015.
More with Emily Rice and space in 2015 tomorrow on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Well, 2014 had a lot of movies in it, and let's look back at 2014 with Kristen and Rafer, Takeaway Movie Date podcast co-hosts. You know, we could review the best movies of the year, right, guys?
Many.
But who wants to do that? That's boring. We can do what actually you are a real resource for, and that is pick out some movies that people might have missed.
Yeah.
Sure.
Tell us what your favorites are this year.
So one of my favorites is called Belle, starring Gugu Mbatha-Raw, and it's based on a true story. She was the mixed-race illegitimate daughter of a respected aristocrat in the 1700s in England, and it explores not just issues of race and class and gender, but when one trumps the other and when love can and can't conquer all.
I remember when you reviewed this, you really went nuts over this movie, Kristen.
We shall be receiving visitors for dinner.
Whoever bothers to visit us here,
or leave except the dead.
Once again, Dido.
Beds, Aunt Mary. We should prepare some extra beds in case our visitors are to stay.
May we wear the new silk?
I will do your hair, bed.
Oh, say we may wear them, Aunt Mary.
You will not be dining with us, Dido.
Of course. But I may join after dinner, may I not?
Yes, such are the rules, and you know them well.
So, 1700s England, it sounds very white there, but it's actually a much more complex story.
Oh, much more complex, and also you see those dynamics in your own family when your own family is treating you differently because of your race, not just the outside world, and how your family may try to change that and may have resistance about that.
Is race behind your pick, Rafer, here?
It certainly is behind one of them. Dear White People was a movie that I just loved this year. It was the first film from a guy named Justin Simeon, and he based it on his own experiences at a college where he was one of the few black students. He came up with his own original storyline. It's about a young girl at the college who is upsetting the system. She has a radio show she does called Dear White People, where she broadcasts broadsides against the established. And it reminded me of Spike Lee. It reminded me of Whit Stillman. It's fresh. It's funny. It's very stylish. And I thought it was like a really authentic glimpse into the minds of the Obama generation that's supposed to be post-racial, but in fact isn't.
And that also went to Ivy League schools in many cases. What's the Ivy League school here?
It's a fake school, and I'm going to forget the name, but it's clearly modeled on Harvard, even though Justin Simeon went to a much more modest school.
Named after a gun, actually. It's called Winchester.
Winchester.
U.S. News and World Report has us as the third most diverse private school that begins with the letter W. And we really hang our hat on that.
When I was applying to Winchester, I checked out the website. They had a black dude in like every picture. But then when I got here, I was like, what happened? Then I realized I'm that dude now. I'm the black dude they use to promote how diverse they are.
Dripping with cynicism.
It is, and it's very funny. And I just think it just... You couldn't reproduce this. You know, you have to be Justin Simien. You have to be a young guy who has been through this and who has lived this to really get that voice and get those experiences in there. And I just think it works wonderfully.
And can I just say also, this movie was a launch pad for a lot of great actors who are now in movies like Selma this year. So
That's right.
It's just great to see all the folks in this movie doing so well after it.
You just can't stay in this century, can you, Christine?
You know I love a bodice ripper. I love those petticoats.
So this next pick is based on an Emile Zola story, right?
Yeah, it's called In Secret. And, you know, if you're going in not knowing what it is, you might start off just thinking, oh, this is a quiet pastoral in the country sort of drama with hoop skirts. But then it turns into something much different.
Will you let me take care of everything, naughty boy?
I wouldn't dream of having it any other way, Mother. We can leave right after the wedding.
Oh, whose wedding are we going to?
Well, yours, dear.
And then the hijinks ensue, I gather.
Oh,
yeah.
When you're forced to marry your cousin, things start getting crazy. And then before you know it, it's a very racy sex movie for a while, and then it turns into a very intriguing thriller at the end. So it's like three different movies in one. I just loved it. Great movie.
Next, Rafer.
I'm going to suggest a movie called The Babadook, which was a horror movie that came out this year. It was the first film from Jennifer Kent. A lot of really great movies, by the way, this year from first-time or second-time filmmakers. This sounds like a familiar story. It's about a single mother and her son. The house is haunted. We all know that story, but this film does something so interesting. It brings all this psychological subtext that we all know is in horror movies, and it brings it right up to the fore, which sounds like kind of an obvious idea, but while I was watching the movie, I kept thinking, I don't think I've ever seen anyone actually do this before.
You know, I saw the most interesting review of this movie in The New Yorker, the first line of which was, from now on, all horror movies should be made by woman directors, because that's what's the key to this movie. It's a feminine sensibility of horror movies, and it actually is very fresh.
Her nose is broken in two places. She's going to need surgery.
I'll pay for everything.
Can't even pay your own bills. Look, I really have to go.
Claire, I think someone is stalking me and Samuel.
What?
A book turned up at our place. I threw it away, but somebody glued it back together and put it on our doorstep.
That's creepy.
It is very creepy. That book, by the way, that she's talking about there is one of the best horror movie books you'll see. It's a great, great prop. Very lovingly made, handmade children's book. And, of course, it's a pop-up book.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's been glued back together, but that sounds creepy. All right, so we can't end this segment without doing haters. There's always an abundance of things to hate from Hollywood this year. Did you guys agree on your hater?
Oh, there's so much to hate this year, but Rafer and I did agree on one movie that we think is so phenomenally horrible that we just could not talk about this.
Can you guess what it is?
You guys have never seen a truck like this before. Get in here. Lock that door.
It doesn't have a lock.
You are gonna love this. Want to hook this back to a working battery?
Calling all
Oh, yeah. I don't think it's a truck at all.
This is how Mark Wahlberg is putting his kids through college. The Transformers franchise, yes?
Yes, Transformers : Age of Extinction, the latest in this horrible, horrible franchise. And, you know, the word extinction should have been used to define the movie and this all. But no, it just feels like it's going to go on and on and on. And in this movie, we have so much absurd, horrible stuff just thrown in there like a mishmash. We have an Irish race car driver. We have a sexually active daughter in short shorts. We have so many
different... You were expecting Samuel Beckett in the Transformers? What? Hello?
Stanley Tucci's in it? I mean, yeah, it's true. I really feel like the franchise has been kind of crumbling for a while, but this one, it just seemed to really go off the rails. I just feel like the film completely lost track of who it was appealing to, what it was trying to do. It's just awful.
Michael Bay at the helm once again here?
Of course.
Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer, co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast.
Thanks, John.
And finally this hour, how might your playlist have changed in 2014? Summer anthems, spring songs, fall rollouts, and oh right, Taylor Swift released an album. John Schaefer, host of WNYC's Soundcheck, is here to tell us about the top songs from 2014. Happy outgoing 2014, John.
Was it a happy 2014, John?
I don't know. Well, you know, not for the Democrats, certainly, no, not for President Obama. But if we were going to play for him a great piece of music that might cheer him up for 2014, what would you start with?
Well, you know, 2014 was a breakout year for a band out of Baltimore called Future Islands. If you were watching The Late Show with David Letterman on the night of March 3rd, you heard and saw one of the great live performances of the year. Caesar's chain. Let your heart just soften you. Caesar's chain. But I've grown tired trying to change for you.
Song Seasons by Future Islands. What did that performance do to them this year?
Well, it got them millions of YouTube views for this live performance of the song, featuring the lead singers, I'll call it dancing. But the most amazing part was, you know how David Letterman often looks like he's just waiting for the band to end so we can get home? He came running over afterward and said, I'll take all of that you got.
Nice going. How about that? I'll take all of that you got. Future Island, that was wonderful. Thank you very much.
That was wonderful. I mean, he was so animated.
Nice.
Yeah, it was really an extraordinary moment for them. And, you know, it has been a very good year for Future Islands in the wake of this debut on network TV.
So we might have missed that, but for David Letterman, what is the pop tune that we actually did miss, probably, because it didn't have a Letterman breakout moment?
Yeah, well, the best pop song that you probably missed in 2014, I think, came from the British rapper known as Itch. It's a song called Another Man, and it features vocals by Megan Joy, who you may know as a loser on American Idol.
Song came out on my birthday.
This song came out of the early 60s, John. I mean, it's just, and if you watch the video, it's mostly in a kind of black and white. I mean, it is a clear throwback to the golden age of the girl groups, and from this British rapper named Itch. So not as much traction here in the States as perhaps it should have had.
And what are you happy to say goodbye to this year?
Well, the best pop song that you probably don't ever need to hear again is, in fact, Happy by Pharrell Williams. Let's not forget, while 2014 has ended with a tank named Taylor Swift, that much of the year belonged to this song by Pharrell.
So are you grumpy? Is that why you're just kicking this out the door?
No, I think it's still a good song. Yeah. I just think we've all heard it many, many times. And some of us have spent quite a few hours watching the 24-hour video of this song by Pharrell. The funny thing is it actually came out in late 2013 because it was part of Despicable Me, too.
That's right.
But his own recording of it, his own record came out this year and just basically owned the summer of 2014.
Coolest indie tune of the year?
I have to say it is probably without a doubt. Can it be probably and without a doubt?
Without a doubt, I think I'm 100% kind of sure. Yeah.
I'm going to go with the song called Coffee by a duo called Sylvan Esso. The hook here is a subtle but really catchy one. Get up, get down. Get up, get down. Feel the rotation and stop. See the next one break. Get up, get down. Get up, get down. Get up. Sentiments the same with the pair of feet change. I know my words will dry upon the skin.
It's sort of a techno Cowboy Junkies.
Well, you know, the name Sylvan Esso, with its combination of a kind of woodsy pastoral image and the old name of ExxonMobil, is a very, you know, provocative kind of name and does go to this kind of combination of different influences in the band.
So there's a Southern hit, electropop duo, Sylvan Esso. What would you take us out with? Something from the North here.
Well, you know,
great white North here.
The hottest spot on the musical map in 2014.
Excluding Taylor again.
Excluding Taylor Swift. Was probably Scandinavia. Sweden has been at the forefront of American pop now for a number of years, but Norway got into the act as well. The Swedish singer Robin did an album with the Norwegian duo Royksopp. The Afro-Norwegian duo Nico and Vince had a big hit with Am I Wrong? Iconopop did a global tour. But for me, the breakout Swedish star of 2014 was the singer Tove Lo, with a great song, a great piece of pop called Habits, which everyone refers to as Stay High. And if you listen, every time she sings the word gotta stay high, she actually sings low. You're gone and I gotta stay high all the time to keep you off my mind. Ooh, 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 high all the time to keep you off my mind. Ooh, 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 spend my days locked in a haze trying to forget you, babe. I fall back down. Gotta stay high all my life to forget I'm missing you. Ooh.
My kids love this tune.
It's a great tune. Yeah. It can be a kind of a disturbing video if you're a parent of a teenage daughter.
Kids love disturbing videos.
But it's a great song and really well written and terrific production.
All right. So a decent playlist for 2014.
Yeah, it was a good year.
It was a good year. A very good year.
It was a very good year.
I'm 90% sure that I'm absolutely certain of that.
John, Happy New Year.
John Schaefer, host of WNYC's Soundcheck. Happy New Year to you. More of your best moments from the year.
Hi, John. This is Paula Steiner. I'm calling from Jacksonville, Florida, and my highlight moment of 2014, I was at an open mic and I was playing Whipping Post, and suddenly I had a lead guitarist, a keyboardist, a drummer, and a bass player, the latter two guys I'd never played with before, all backing me up at once. Otherwise, with all the family deaths, medical expenses, car trouble, housing renovations, and tooth extractions, the year has sucked. What am I looking forward to? A year less problematic than this one.
Turn over a new leaf there, Paula. From Little Rock, Arkansas, our son was diagnosed with autism and a severe speech delay in late 2013. My breakthrough moment was when his developmental preschool teacher called me this year and said he was singing and dancing at school. Before this day, our son had cried all day at school, literally all day, every day. When his teacher called to say he was happy, then it was my turn to cry. I'm looking forward to 2015 because I think there's a good chance we will get the news that our son will be able to attend a mainstream kindergarten. And even if we don't, 2015 will still be a year of great progress.
This is Esther from Jacksonville, Florida. The highlight of this year was the birth of my second son. Seeing it wasn't my first rodeo, the experience was wonderful, a lot better than the first. Even though my husband had just begun a hike of the Appalachian Trail and missed the delivery, I look forward to seeing all their new milestones in the new year. Many blessings to come.
Here's wishing everyone blessings in the coming year. Thanks so much for listening. Happy New Year, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.